What up, everybody? It's your boy Joel here for another episode of the Global Citizen Podcast. I was in Port-au-Prince, Haiti for a week during Carnival, and it was 86 degrees, 90 degrees, and now it's cold and rainy in New York City. I'm actually not in the 718 today. I'm at the 212 recording from the New School. Shout out to, I don't even know what the New School mascot is, but shout out to everyone who went to the New School when I was here. And so while it's cold and rainy in New York City, somewhere in Florida and Arizona, pitchers and catchers are getting ready for some baseball, baby, the 2016 MLB season. I would actually like to take this opportunity to thank the New York Mets for being relevant again. It takes away kind of pain from the Knicks sucking, and also just the Mets have been best for so long, and it's that newfound joy. You don't want to be too happy. But it's good seeing a team in the 718 thrive. On the 718 thrive, really. But on the line to discuss Los Mets y Los Yankees and TV and movies is my guest and friend, Alfonso Morgan. Welcome. So welcome to the show. Welcome to the Global Citizen Podcast.
What's up, man? Thanks for having me.
So before we get into baseball, I want to give people a chance who don't care about baseball to let them know that there is something juicy at the end. Why don't you tell me and the fans what do you do, what it is that you do?
Well, at the moment right now, I'm in my first year of working as a staff writer for True Detective and basically generally for HBO. We kind of bounce around in terms of like the shows that we work on. And so I'm in my fourth month now working. So I'm basically, this is the show I've been assigned to, and it's, you know, it's been a lot of fun. I've learned so much. You know, I originally, you know, went to film school like about 2 years ago at this point. Yeah. And so my original intent was to work in films and, you know, just kind of hopefully one day be directing. And that's what I want to do. You know, I'm still young. So, but this is a great, you know, working for these guys is really incredible. I've learned so much, and, you know, just kind of reaching professional grade for the first time is definitely, you know, exhilarating and challenging, but, you know, it's good stuff. It's a good situation.
What's it like to kind of do something that you've always wanted to do? Like, it sounds like, you know, this is something you really geared up for. And First of all, what's it like doing something that you love? And what's it like when you first learn, like, yo, I'm going to be doing something actually cool? Is it like, this is a long-winded question, but is it like, yeah, of course I was going to get here? Or is it just kind of like, oh my God?
Well, it's weird. It's strange because I always think that, you know, I think if you work, I never presupposed that like I'm going to get something necessarily, even though, like, you know, my passion has always been filmmaking, you know, even from as it sounds cliche, because that's like what all of people that work in that say, but it is the truth. I mean, I really have never envisioned myself doing anything else. And I feel that I'm just, you know, kind of just doing it for as long as it's possible for me to do it until maybe I, like, am bad enough that people don't like give me jobs anymore. but I mean, it's so far it's been so given that I've always like worked with a sense of not necessarily fear, but just, you know, just trying to be the best that I could possibly be, because of the fact that I never think that this is a very guaranteed job. It's not the type of thing where people go looking for you. It's more so that you really want to be submitting material to different festivals, to different, you know, I went to NYU film school, so there are professors there that would always try and, like, you know, kind of connect you with guys in the industry. So it's cool to work in something that I'm doing, but it's kind of, I wouldn't say that it's the type of thing where it's like, of course I'm going to be here. I definitely work with guys who think that way, and they're very talented, but my mindset is more so just, you know, I've been given the opportunity to kind of earn a job in a way, or to kind of, you know, prove myself and prove to myself as well as to others that, you know, what I always wanted to be that I can possibly, or at least try to be, what I envision myself being when I was, you know, a young kid. So it's cool, but it's definitely, it's like, you know, it's kind of like a job, you know, you're earning a job. That's how I view it.
That's a great way to look at it. And it's really cool that you are really kind of in a position to kind of achieve your dream. And we'll talk more about it. I definitely want to hear your thoughts on, well, what you've been doing with True Detective and HBO, but just other TV and movies in general, what you've thought of them for, I guess, 2015 and early 2016. But so are you are a New York native, born and raised?
Yeah, I was born in the Bronx on Walton Avenue, 184th Street. And for those, I don't know if listeners know that area, but then shortly after, I think like about 4 or 5 years later, my family moved out to Harlem. And so I've lived in Harlem ever since. But yeah, I mean, either way you look at it, I was avenues away from Yankee Stadium. So I'm one of the guys I'm not a bandwagoner. You know, I grew up in the city, and I grew up in the part of the city that, you know, validates me being a Yankee fan. So I'm just mentioning that because I'm excited for the baseball season too. But I am born and raised in New York City.
Great segue. And you know what? 10 years ago, the conversation would have ended in a fight. But I'm older, way more mature. I actually respect the fact that you were born and raised in the Bronx, at least in the early part of your life. That really gives you a lot of reason just to be a real Yankee fan. And, you know, being from Queens, anytime I came across a Yankee fan in Queens, I would just get mad. But, you know, people like attaching themselves to a winner. I can't blame them. But so you're excited for the 2016 season. Are you excited about your borderline criminal new closer or...
I mean, it's weird. That's a weird situation because MLB still hasn't kind of laid down, you know, the hammer in terms of what it's going to do. I think Jose Reyes just got like a paid leave or something. So,
right.
You know, he's the other, right. I anticipate, it's weird because the Yankees they really improved on a part of their team that they didn't really need to improve in. I think that if last year I don't think they lost the game after they led after 8 innings. So, obviously I think he has more star power now. And like, you know, Chapman throws, you know, over 100 miles per hour, almost 103. And it's the type of thing where, I mean, but I anticipate not having him for a part of the season. Like I anticipate him being suspended for maybe 20 games, you know, you never know, maybe more. So I'm excited about that, but to be honest with you, I'm not even really excited for the reasons that most people are excited about the season. I probably most Yankee fans, like, you know, my brothers and stuff and friends that I grew up with, most of them, like, when I tell them why I'm excited about the season, they get kind of, they're like, why would that be exciting to you? Which is that I'm just excited because for the first time really in my whole life is like, I'm anticipating a team that I'm not positive is going to just, you know, dominate, you know, not at all. You know, it's like, I've just never really experienced that. And like, maybe I wouldn't have been as excited when I was a kid. And like, I grew up with, you know, the Lightning, you know, Jeter, you know, A-Rod, Matsui, Giambi, Sheffy, you know, like not in that order, but just like an insanely all-star, you know, driven lineup, that a team that wins 100 games every year.
Firepower. But you grew up with firepower.
Yeah. And so, but in a way, what I learned growing up with that is that that doesn't really win you championships. Like, I mean, that team tried to do that with that contract from like 2003 to 2009, and it finally won in 2009. But I mean,
against the Phillies.
Yeah, right. Against the Phillies. But the weird thing is that for the first time ever, it's like this Yankee team is pretty much I just want to see good competitive games, and I don't even know how far they're going to get. But that's exciting to me. It's like, for the first time, it's like, let's see if the Yankees, like, can really earn their value, you know, just based off of just who's the best, you know, not who bought the best players, just, you know, I like the chances, but at the same time, I can't say that I know where they're going to end up. But I'm excited for that. I just think the parity in baseball these days is amazing. It's just, there's just so much competition all up and down each division. I mean, you know, it's amazing. I'm really excited.
You know, I date you in age by, I don't know, I would say a good 7-8 years probably. Yeah. So, for me, I grew up, the Mets were always sucking. And, you know, I think the Yankees really started to take off for me. I could remember like 95, 96. So, 95, they lost to Seattle. That it's a famous Ken Griffey Jr. slide into home plate.
Oh man, that's all I've got.
But 96 they won, but they were more of like a grinded out beat you team, and then they just kind of started to take off and just kind of
they had kind of the Royals of last year in a way. That 96 team is kind of similar, like kind high of, contact, very yeah. patient.
Exactly. Yeah. I think they probably had better pitching than this Royals yeah. team. Yeah, but, you know, the Yankees were good for a while, and then they just started really to throw money at people. I think, you know, the first big contract was the Giambi one, and then it just they kind of went down, and a lot of their star players weren't panning out. They were getting hurt. But one thing I must say about this generation's Yankees, so, you know, the 2000 teens, Joe Girardi is, to me, the linchpin of that team. He's not a player. It's a coach. But I really, you know, I like them as a player, and I like him even more as a coach. I think he is – I would put him, you know, top three best coaches in baseball. You know, I know people give Joe Maddon a lot of praise because he's won rings, but he's won Manager of the Year in two different divisions and has taken teams from the depths – to, you know, first place or wild card finishes. But I think Girardi is really good at working with what he has. And there have been years where he's had power lineup. There are years where he's had to grind it out. And I think that for the first time, Cashman has really taken into what Girardi has been asking for. And I think this is going to be a grind it out team. I think you guys are going to steal bases. I think you guys are going to basically cut the game off. I think once the sixth inning is over, your bullpen will really kind of bridge it because your pitchers aren't young. Maybe you got what's his name? The guys you guys got from Seattle.
From Seattle. Pineda.
Yeah, Pineda, you know, Severino, the young guys. But it's not the old arms of, you know, the Mussinas. CC is a shell. But I could see why you're excited.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing where I think, you know, you have Brett. It's what you said is right in terms of, you know, it is a grind out team but that's all based off of how, if it stays healthy. It's like the Yankees are a team that could win 70 games or they're a team that could win 90. You know, like that's the range of just everything could go wrong. You know, I mean, Tanaka could, his elbow could finally give out. You know, Ellsbury and Gardner could get hurt again. A-Rod and Teixeira, you know, like something could happen to them, you know, like, so if that goes wrong, it'd be a disaster, or it could be really good. I'm excited about it. It's a cool team. And I actually have a feeling that the rotation, if it stays healthy, could actually do some really good things. I think Masahiro Tanaka will probably make a comeback. You know, I think that he just had elbow surgery. So I think, but not the one on the ligament, but he just kind of, I think he was clearing out some bone spurs.
So not Tommy John.
No, not Tommy John, no. But this one, he said, I think a couple of days ago, that he feels his elbows cleared out more and he kind of doesn't have the same things. And like he said that he thinks he could match the time when he first got into the league, those first like 14 starts where he went like 11-2 and he was like, I think his ERA was like at 2-something, you know, in the low 2s. So, you know, he could be a good pitcher, and you never know what you could get from Severino and all these guys. So it'll be cool, man. I mean, it's exciting. I will say, you know, if I was a Mets fan, I would be 10 times more excited because that's a team that really has – I mean, that's a team that has a chance to really go far. I mean, like – and I mean, you know.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, you expect that too. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, other than Cubs, I mean, who's really projecting better? I mean – it's weird. Like, the Royals are just, people are just afraid to count them because they keep doing it each year and they're good. But I mean, the Royals starting staff is like, I mean, I'm wondering, like, are they even going to be good? Because they have Edinson Volquez, Yordano Ventura, and Ian Kennedy as like the top three starters. But then again, they will do it. So, I mean, other than the Cubs, the Mets are favorite teams to you know, make a deep run into the postseason.
You know, I'm scared to agree, but, you know, the Mets look really, really impressive on paper. based on that rotizzy, that rotation of just arms. But, you know, baseball, I feel like, unlike other sports, is a sport that's super unpredictable. Like, in basketball, you could be like, oh, you know, the Warriors are going to win a lot of games. The Spurs always look good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But baseball, like last year, no one thought the Mets were going to win the division. You know, last year I wanted to compete for that second wild card, and then things just happen. I don't know who thought the Astros were going to be as good as they were last year, but now people have them going to the World Series. And I think with baseball, especially baseball, health is everything. If someone, you know, key gets hurt, it really could set you back a whole lot.
Yeah, that's very true. But this is why I think that – this is the thing with the Mets. I think that they're the one team that I think health won't even really be that much – they're the one thing that I think – one team that I think could overcome health because they have such a deep rotation. Like, for example, let's say Steven Matz goes down with something. Let's say Bartolo Colon, something happens to him. You know, maybe DeGrom needs some rest at the end of the season. You still – you have Zach Wheeler. Like, you have – it's literally like a rotation of just – I mean, I really think the Mets are going to be able to – because they have so much depth, I think they're going to be able to overcome a lot. They got Cespedes now. You know, that puts their offense, you know, in like – you know, before that I said the offense is going to be all right. Now I think the offense is going to be – it's good offense, not an excellent offense, but it's good. But then again, that there's depth there too. Some let's say Cespedes gets hurt maybe for some time. You still have guys like Diaza. You have – I mean, there's just a lot of depth with the Mets, in my opinion. Not bullpen-wise. That's probably the only weak point. Not weak, but it's not strong either. You know, it's just good. It, you know, it's decent before you get to Familia. But I think the Mets are going to be one of those teams that don't have to worry that much about injuries because it's a young team. And I don't know. I think they're going to be good. I think they'll be pretty good.
We'll wait and see. I mean, I think for me, especially, you know, the World Series really just showed – the Royals really exploited us. They showed all our holes, was we couldn't manufacture runs. We were weak in the infield in terms of defense. And, you know, that's why – it's probably why Murphy didn't come back. I'm really happy that we shored up shortstop, and I'm very happy that Wilmer Flores is still a Met. You know, I think that's a sentimental thing, but I also think I think there's a lot of potential in him. But for me, what I'm still kind of worried about with the Mets, you know, it's little things, but the little things matter. The world showed that. I really am. I've seen enough of Darno. He's a good young player, and I think hopefully a full season of him will show otherwise. But they really just ran all over him. The world just ran all over him, and. You know, the Mets, we're used to having bad defensive catchers, but our last really bad defensive catcher is not in the Hall of Fame because he hit, 500 home runs, close to it?
Yeah, I mean, he's the greatest offensive catcher in the history of the game. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. And I really hope that, you know, I don't know, he's been working on that arm. I also think for us, we just need to really – that infield defense needs to get shored up, and I think that teams that are as good as the Royals will find holes. And
here's the thing though. I mean, the problem that you had with Murphy is just an all around. He's just not a good defender. You know, you know Flores. I don't think he necessarily feels the ball all that well. He probably has decent range. But the thing about the two new guys you have now, which is Neil Walker, that's a solid second baseman, and you also have Asdrubal Gurriel. Those guys maybe lack in range, but what's good about them is that if the ball, like, they will field the ball when it is hit to them. They will field it. They will make accurate throws. There isn't any. That's what I like about their defense now, which is that I think that. And here's the thing. I mean, you can prepare to face teams like the Royals. However, I don't think there are many teams that are like the Royals that are going to make a deep run into the playoffs. Maybe, honestly, the Royals and maybe the Astros are the only teams that maybe resemble each other in terms of the speed game that they play. But, I mean, I think this is like a bold statement. Everybody probably, you know, probably say it's weird or crazy. But I don't think the Cubs are going to be better than – I don't think the Cubs are – I think if the Cubs are – it's the Cubs and the Mets that are the best team in the National League. I think they're going to face off in the NLCS. And I don't think the Cubs really have the answer to the Mets pitching. I don't think anybody really does. I think that the Cubs still strike out a lot. It doesn't matter who's in that lineup. They're still going to strike out a lot. I don't think – I mean, it doesn't matter who you put up against, Harvey, DeGrom, Syndergaard, you know, probably Mats, or we'll see who's the game four starter. Well, that's – I'm this is assuming that everything goes well.
I know.
But,
you're thinking way, way ahead. I mean, that's great. Thank you. But one thing –
I just think there aren't that many – aren't that many fast – I don't think there are that many teams that play the game like the Royals. So I don't think the Mets need to worry too much about teams exploiting a defense that I think has less holes. Yeah, maybe it still has some holes, but I think it has less holes than it did before.
No, it definitely has less holes. But, again, you know, with baseball, you got to wait. You know, I think the Cardinals were hurt last year.
Yeah, that's true.
That the NL East – I'm sorry, the AL East was kind of a – disaster after the Blue Jays. I mean, the Yankees played consistent ball all year, but you know, every year there is a sleeper team. Who knows how good Arizona is going to be now that they, you know, they have
with Grant and Miller. That's exactly true.
So it's a wait and see. It's a wait and see thing. I think that as long as that rotation stays healthy for the Mets, at least we, you know, I think we can definitely contend. One more question on the Yankees, and we'll move on. So what do you think about you guys acquired Starlin Castro, who's been kind of I guess he hasn't really been an enigma, but I think people expected him to be the next Alfonso Soriano.
Yeah, they did, yeah. He was when he came up, that's who mentored him, you know, with the Cubs.
Right. Are you excited? Do you think they'll move him around? Do you think he'll just kind of be your second baseman? Do you think he'll play a little outfield?
I think they will move him around. I mean, they have something in terms of Chase Headley that, you know, you don't know. I think he's a good player, but I think you're gonna have to give him some kind of backups from now and, you know, now and then. And so I think that Starlin Castro is gonna kind of get some reps at third. But I think what impresses me about Starlin Castro, it excites me, I guess, is just, I mean, this is a guy who almost has, people don't recognize this, he's just been playing for a while, which is probably why, but he had 200 hits in his first season in the majors, which is kind of like, a lot of people don't remember that, but he did. And he almost has 1,000 hits in his professional career. So the people say that the reason that he kind of, you know, started to struggle with the Cubs was that he was on a really bad team for a while. And so he's batting number three, and there's a lot of pressure. You know, he's batting the three spot, the four spot. There's a lot of pressure for him to be the main producer. He's on a team where he's probably going to be batting seventh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's just so liberating for a guy like that. So I don't know. He might just be really good. You know what I mean? And the Yankees don't need him to be really good. The Yankees actually need him to bat 270. Literally, but he could show more. So I think if honestly, they're looking for a good middle. They're looking for a good combination between Gregorius and Castro up the middle defensively. And that's what they really care about. I think he's definitely an upgrade offensively, and I think he's going to be good. And just one thing really quickly, I just mentioned Gregorius because honestly, that's my favorite player on the team. Not a lot of people.
Didi.
Yeah. It's weird. You know, he was a finalist for the Gold Glove. He didn't win it, you know, because Alcides Escobar won it in the American League, and he probably will never win it now that the best stop defensively to the American League, Andrelton Simmons from the Braves. The guy's amazing, but but it really reassures me that Gregorius, we do have one of the best defensive shortstops in the game, you know, and I think that's really important to have.
That's cool, man. Good luck to your Yankees. I mean that with all respect. I mean that.
No, that's cool. I appreciate that coming from a Mets fan. And I legitimately listen. We deserve that at this point because you guys are the town. So we at least deserve some kind comments. You know, just you know, because there's nothing bad anyone can say about the Mets anymore. Nothing you can say.
I think most Mets fans are still afraid. So real quick, while I still have you, so True Detective. So you, like you said, you are one of, I'm sure, various writers for the upcoming season of True Detective. As a fan of True Detective, season one was pretty great, and season two was It wasn't that great, man. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people feel the same way.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, did you kind of, I mean, I don't know how much you can comment on this, but did you watch both seasons, and did you see a difference in the two? Do you think there was one that's better, or is that towing the line too much?
No. I think we could. I mean, one of the things, it's funny, you know, one of the interesting things that happens is that when you get the job for these things, there's just kind of like a general consensus that the group arrives to as a whole. And so that it's basically, this is what was wrong with, this is what we need to improve on, this is what we want to improve on. And so each writer needs to write with that in mind. Obviously, they want you to individually bring your talents to the table, but you know, you don't want to branch off and kind of start creating your own show if it doesn't go with like what we generally came to an agreement on. So
right.
So what I mean is, like, even though I could maybe have personal assessments of the previous season, that doesn't really matter because the job is to use my talents as much as possible to create a good, to fulfill the kind of concept that we've come to, which is that in season three, this is what we need to do in order to kind of expand and improve on what happened in season two. I know that's not a very specific answer, but what I will say is that season two there was a lot happening in season two, a lot more than in season one. And so a lot of people, you know, a lot of reviews were that things were a little bit too complicated. Without, obviously, I can't give away any details or anything, but one of the things I strive for now in the writing room is simplification of content and of, like, specific action with an emphasis on the actions in and of themselves being a lot more profound and having bigger implications for the characters and just kind of... So I will say there will be less intricacy in terms of what's happening, so I don't think the audience will get as confused, and after a while they probably won't feel like, oh, this is like, you know, what ended up happening here, what's the point of this thing that's happening. I think things, we're trying to just kind of centralize things a little more and kind of just emphasize, you know, if we were boxers, we're trying to just hit with just some strong strong kind of body shots
instead of doing the Ryu Hadouken. I think, you know, the thing about True Detective every year is extremely different and nothing really spills over. But a lot of great shows, I'll just talk about The Wire, for example. You know, season one was so good. For those who've watched The Wire, season one was so good. And season two, a lot of people really didn't like it, even though I like season two a lot. But that's really cool, man. So when when someone comes to you and they come to you, they're like, hey, Alfonso, we like you. We want you to be a writer for True Detective. And then you guys meet, I guess, and say, here's what we're trying to do. Like, where do you draw inspiration from? Like, are you like...
I'm the weird guy in the room. I mean, I'm strange because I'll be honest with you. I mean, this is a funny story, which is that... It's not really a story, but this is like a detail, which is that I don't really watch television. I mean, I'm a huge, like, film guy, and I really... My goal in life, my mini goal is to try and, like, be as informed as possible in terms of, like, film history. So I'll spend this month, like, you know, watching Westerns from the 50s, or I'll spend next month trying to, you know, see what was going on in the Italian neorealist movement in the 40s or the Japanese new wave in the 70s. You know, when I was told about this show, it had nothing to do with my knowledge of television. It just had to do more so with my writing approach and just kind of what I had kind of written before, just kind of different things for different guys. My inspiration, though, really does come from films, the body of films that's existed. It's a young medium, but, you know, I mean, very specifically, one of the things that I was very inspired by that kind of helped me in my recent writing over the past year have been films noir from the 50s. Not so much the film noir movement is something that kind of came to light as a kind of combination of the kind of pulp fiction detective novels that existed in the early 40s and late 30s in combination with the visual scheme of the German expressionist filmmakers. And so that kind of gets its first expression in a film that is not a film noir in Citizen Kane. That's where the visual kind of influence comes from. And then narratively, the influence comes from the Maltese Falcon. So those are two 1941 films that kind of then become really popular. And then so this whole genre kind of formed after that throughout the 40s and 50s. And so, I mean, just to name a couple films that inspired me for the specific style that that's been inspired my writing is, The Sweet Smell of Success, 1957, Touch of Evil, 1957, The Asphalt Jungle, Force of Evil, Odds Against Tomorrow, which actually has an African-American star, or Caribbean-American star as well, Harry Belafonte. But that's where the main inspiration comes from. It mainly comes from there. It's not very TV based. I feel like a newcomer to television, but it's so interesting. It shows you that at the end of the day, we're just trying to write good stories. So it doesn't matter where you come from in terms of your influences. If you have just the right approach and you're essentially just crafting good material, I think the world will receive it.
You know, it's a few things. Like, I feel like the director of True Detective probably really saw that in you and just wants to pull in everything. I'm sure other people write completely different than you and just kind of wants to be able to have a couple episodes or scenes with your film background, the film noirs. So you recommended, but it was actually a very good movie. So as a young man, what makes you to like watch those movies? Because when I was a kid, I was not watching film noir. I was watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I was watching Rocky 1-5.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I was watching Van Damme movies. Like, I did not have good taste.
No, I don't. I wouldn't say that those aren't good taste. I mean, Bloodsport and Total Recall are two of my favorite action movies. So I
the three breast scene word, I like that too.
But it's actually weird. That's not what I really grew up watching as a teenager either. I liked films. I've always liked them. I guess from the ages of like 14 to maybe 17, I think I started to see more serious films, but they were still like American films, the films of Scorsese, such as Goodfellas or Casino or Taxi Driver, those kind of films, Raging Bull, other films by Bob Zemeckis or films by David Fincher. But I didn't really get into things like Citizen Kane or anything like that until I had this teacher in high school that he was really just exposing us to quite a bit of material, literary from in terms of literature. But he knew that I was into films, and so he kind of started to tell me about all these really apparently films that he would like tell me about these titles, and then after the title he would say, I mean, that's one of the greatest films ever made, and he would say that each time. I'm like, really? Like, I've never heard about that film, but like he would say it's the greatest, like it's one of the great. He's like you can't not see that. So Citizen Kane was one of those. Seven Samurai was another one of those. The Virgin Spring, this Swedish film was one of those. And so that's really like, that was like around 17, 18, my senior year of high school. And then from then on, that's when I really started to just dig deep into the history of films. And so it's not that I grew up watching those, but after a while, you kind of seek, I guess once you see the best of the contemporary films, you start to get interested in what was made before. And that's kind of, that goes in tandem with me deciding at that time that was what I wanted to make my career. So you start to just get into the specifics. It's like, you just start to appreciate the history and get into, just the little nooks and crannies of what's happened in the past. And I think that's going to be a lifelong process, because I discover things, each month that I didn't know about before. For right now I'm looking at the films of Delmer Davies, this guy from the 50s that he made a film called 310 to Yuma, which got remade a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he remade it.
The original one. And his films are pretty interesting. I didn't know anything about him, and so now I'm learning. So I think it's just being around, the right people, and when you get more intensive in a field, I think you start to really want to just kind of explore more.
So being basically a movie buff and a student of the game, if you want to say, or a student of the industry, what do you think of the movies from, we'll just go from 2015. We won't go too back. You know, since you are really kind of really in like a someone who really has done their homework, this is your career. What have you thought of the movies that have come out? Has any movie, and I guess in the past 1 to 2 years, has one come out where you were like, yo, that was beautiful? Or have you been kind of disappointed?
1 to 2 years. I really liked, I mean, the recent movie, I think everybody liked them, but it really is just amazing. The Revenant, I really liked that. I thought it was, that's like a really, that's bringing cinema back to just the kind of the metaphysical elements, but also making, not sacrificing, I guess you could say, just of the invigorating potential of filmmaking. So I really liked that film a lot. I mean, that came out this year. In 2015, I really, you know, I loved 12 Years a Slave. I thought that was the deserving winner, and I'm really happy that it did win. That was 2014. 2015.
Right, that was 2014, yep.
Yeah, that was 2014. 2015, I wasn't high on Birdman, but it was a great film, it was wonderfully made. I just wasn't that excited about the concept, and it was hard for me to take it very seriously, even though I think there was, I mean, incredible performances, and the filmmaker's the same guy that made The Revenant, so I thought it was amazing. It was good, but it wasn't to my taste. So recently, yeah, I think I probably would say that The Revenant is probably the film that I liked most. Yeah.
Okay. Jumping back to TV. So you said that you really weren't always kind of like a TV watcher, and now you're writing a script for it, which is a very popular show for a very popular network. Have you been watching TV now? I mean, have you been like, you know, let me watch a couple of shows? Because I can tell you TV has changed a lot in the past 5 to 10, especially with Netflix, where you're able to just kind of bang out series, just have them on there like that. But have you been watching, and what has like caught your attention?
I'll say, well, here's the thing. I have a problem where I'm afraid of television because I think that when I get into it, the shows are so good now that I'll get hooked on one. So I don't watch more than one at a time. But the one show that I am pretty engaged in, that I just really like, and it's really good, is Shameless. It's a Showtime. Mm-hmm. Production. I think one of the most underrepresented aspects of society, or just elements within society, are the underprivileged classes, as well, you know, low income neighborhoods. And it's a film that kind of shows with a lot of truth and a lot of empathy, as well as conviction at the same time. It shows the experience through which kind of this family in the South Side of Chicago goes through, and it's not like a family of color. It's not a Hispanic family. It's a white family, and so I thought that was pretty truthful too, because I think a lot of the labeling in terms of low income communities is that they're all, you know, they're all black or Hispanic, or, you know, and I think that showing this just kind of allows that kind of racial barrier to be broken, and allows us to see that the plight of people within that social class really is something that is not limited to race, and it is something that just focusing very much on the conditions and the dysfunctionality and the complexity and the psychology and the negative effects that the societal conditions have on these people, as well as what I love about the show is that it doesn't completely blame the society these people lived in. It holds the people very accountable. It definitely indicates the fact that these people are just as much responsible for the situation as the conditions that they've, you know, the terrible hand that they've been dealt. So it's a very truthful show. It's very, very well made. And I think stylistically, I like it from the filmmaking standpoint. So Shameless is the show I really like. Yeah, I will say I really do like it. I don't know if I can say that working for a rival network, but I just did. So it's cool.
Maybe I'll edit it out.
No, it's fine.
That's really cool. I think since Shameless, you know, you bring a good point. I think the only show that I could recall since Shameless that really talked about kind of low-income white family struggling with poverty was Roseanne, and that was like
early 90s,
late 80s. Roseanne's a personal favorite of my girlfriend.
Really? I didn't even know that.
She eats it up. But now I'm trying to think, like, there aren't really other shows that really, really, really talk about it. Let me ask you, let's go back to the Oscars real quick. What do you think about, like, the recent movement of really African-American actors trying to boycott or boycotting, at least? I think everyone's boycotting except for Chris Rock. Do you think that there is a lack of diversity in Hollywood?
A lack of diversity, you would say.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because this is interesting from the moment that I would say that my first entrance into, I guess, the realm of kind of professional filmmaking really started even when I got into NYU Film School back when I was 18, and from that very moment I was always really the only person of color really working for the most part around the people that I would that you would call your peers and that you're competing with and that you're collaborating with. And it's very interesting because there certainly is a lack of diversity, and it's troubling because you want the country to kind of be, you know, television and film has such a power to kind of be a representative form of showing what the country is, you know, culturally, psychologically. And so if a certain cultural group is not really being presented as, you know, is not present, then it just really kind of skews your, you know, the overall perception of the nation. And so it is really troubling. I find that the lack of diversity is discouraging. But I also think at the same time, it's strange. I mean, I know boycotting can, I don't know how to feel about that, because I do think that, I just get motivated by it because I think it's that we have to just kind of make films with people as people of color as protagonists. We need to make them really good. I think that was why I like 12 Years a Slave so much, which is that, look, we can make a film that's just as good as The Revenant, if not better. And it can have an entirely black cast, you know, right. That's a masterpiece. That's an art, you know, that fits art house standards, that fits mainstream standards. I mean, that's a film that, you know, really brought, I went to the theater and I mean, people were crying when they saw that. And so I don't know what boycotting, it's tough. I don't know what boycotting really achieves necessarily in this scenario. Not that I'm against boycotting in general. I'm definitely not. But I don't know what it achieves necessarily here, because I do think that art is the kind of thing where quality is the main thing. And so I know that maybe productions aren't being given as much a chance if the focus is on maybe having a black or Hispanic protagonist or lead. But I do think we just have to keep fighting for that, because I think that the way to do it is just to prove that you are the best, and that you can do the best possible thing, you know, that's out. And I think that's happened before and it can happen again. I mean, there was a time when you know, baseball was just an all-white sport. We were just talking about baseball and the Bob Gibsons and the Jackie Robinsons. Well, I'll say Jackie Robinson first because he's the first one.
Right.
Jackie Robinson and the Bob Gibsons and Roberto Clemente. I mean, and now it's the type of industry where you're not looking to Josh Hamilton to be the main star. You know, you're signing Albert Pujols. Ken Griffey Jr. just got into the Hall of Fame, going down probably as the greatest baseball player, top three to ever live, you know. So I think, I know sports is different maybe, but it's at the end of the day, I think this is a competitive country. And I think that it's the kind of thing where you can't I think you can protest, but you have to protest via action as well. You have to keep yourself in the realm of competition. You don't want to step out of the ring and say, I'm not going to fight if I'm not respected. I think you've got to fight in the ring, and I think you maybe have to give a speech afterwards, a victory right. speech, or even a speech after maybe you've lost and said, hey, this is why I lost. Maybe I wasn't given as much of a fair shot. Maybe they put some water by the edge of the ring so that I could slip, but I'll let you know that it happened and I still stayed in the ring and I fought.
Right.
So that's what I say in terms of that. I don't, it might be a long-winded answer, but
no, it's thank you. Thank you for that answer, cuz you are, you know, you're in it, not necessarily from the acting perspective, from the Ryan perspective. Let me bring up one more point, because we're still going, but this is a real great conversation. Something you said really resonated with me, like, you know, with like 12 Years a Slave, where it was, you know, all black cast and, you know, black writer, just everything, and we could win. You know, two movies that I saw that really focus on the trials and tribulations of people of color, I guess within the past 6 months, was Beasts of No Nation and Creed. And Creed, you know, I thought Creed was great, you being a Rocky fan, but Michael B. Jordan, I thought he did an exceptional job.
Yeah.
But Beasts of No Nation, which was on Netflix and also in the theater, which was headlined by Idris Elba, was an all-black cast. And, you know, the interesting thing is that a lot of those dudes in the movie, you know, clearly they're all black, they're all from various parts of Africa. But for people who don't know, like, Nigerian films, they don't know who these guys are. And
right.
I think a lot of people would just see them as just kind of just extra number one, but some of them were actual like famous movie stars in their own right. And I kind of like that you said that, you know, we can make movies, but I just also like the fact that we show diversity in, and that's why it's really refreshing to talk to you, because hearing your past and hearing how it's influenced you and how you're able to spin it into a, you know, a detective mystery on HBO.
Right.
It's very inspiring, man.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, you know, these conversations, I think, are the ones that should be had. I think that, I think that ultimately, I remember I wrote this even as a younger guy. I think I might have been 16 or 15, but I've wanted, and I still will fight for this. I hope that I can go to the record and say that the films that I make in the future will have, will have black protagonists, will have, you know, Hispanic leads, and we'll just, much not just for the sake of, though, and they'll be just as good as a Tom Hanks movie, and they'll be just as good as a Leo DiCaprio movie. I can promise that. And I think we just have to keep fighting. You mentioned Creed. I loved Creed. I didn't see the Idris Elba film.
Beast of No Nation. Oh, I would recommend.
Yeah, I knew that the Idris Elba. I heard good things from it. I just hadn't been able to see it, but I like Creed a lot, because I think it. Michael B. Jordan really just. I mean, he asserted himself as a legitimate star, and I think he worked within the genre. It's a good fighting movie. It's a good boxing movie. Some of those fighting scenes, I mean, some of the best I've seen in a long time. And in a boxing,
he actually got tagged in that movie a couple times.
Oh, really?
It really hit him.
Wow. Yeah. You could tell he really put the work in there. Like,
yeah.
That was a real, you know, visceral performance. And so I think I'm encouraged by those things. So, I mean, at the same time, I see those as positives. I mean, the tough thing is Michael B. Jordan doesn't get nominated, you know, and that's.
Right.
And that's a difficult thing. I guess that's what people are saying in terms of, people are saying that in terms of, you know, well, why didn't he get nominated? You know, but then Sylvester Stallone did. That's a tricky situation. And I think that's valid to a certain extent. But I think we can't get discouraged. I think he has to go and make another movie. And I think he will get, I mean, he did get nominated before. So it's a complicated issue.
Definitely. Alfonso, man, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on the Global Citizen podcast. Do you have anything you want to plug?
No, I mean, I'm just happy to have had this conversation. You know, I think run a good program, I think that, you know, these are good times. It's a good conversation. I hope that I know it's going to be a great baseball season, and anytime that I can discuss baseball, you know, I take advantage of it because, you know, I'm like counting the days, man. It's, you know, April 4th couldn't come any sooner.
No, it's going to be an exciting season. Are you on social media? Do you have a Twitter thing you want to put out, or do you keep it, incognito?
Oh, yeah, no, I don't have a Twitter. No, I don't have any of those things.
It's all right.
Sorry for that.
Do not be sorry for that, man. I was giving you the opportunity. You're doing way bigger things than being on Twitter like me.
No, yeah. I mean, I think people on Twitter have. I think it takes a certain skill. I'm not the best. I think it's an art form to be able to have good. What do they call them? Like Twitter handles. I don't really go on that, but I think it's a skill. So I don't broach into that because I don't know how good I'd be at it. But I've never been big on social media either.
You sound like one of my friends who he almost prides himself. But thanks again for being on. You can follow me on Twitter at JOWY25. And we'll post this as soon as possible. Alfonso, thanks a lot, man.
Of course, man. It's always good times. Thanks for having me. Yo, my man Fife Diggy, he got something to say. I like him brown, yellow, Puerto Rican, and Haitian. Name is Fife Dog from the Zulu Nation. So you're in the jam that we can get down. Now let's knock the...